those of you who don't know, today's sutta is the Upekalesa Sutta, which is number 128 in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's an excellent sutta. I thought I'd gone through it before, but it's not on the list of suttas which have been recorded. So even if it has been done before, it's good to for me to go over it again so that it can be a resource on the internet. And this particular sutta is a favourite sutta of mine. First of all, it describes what to me as an abbot, leader of a monastery, is the ideal monastic situation. And these were the group of the three monks who the Buddha praised because of their lifestyle and their simplicity in the way they related to each other was a cause for them getting very beautiful meditations. And this particular sutta, above all, shows the difficulties you face in order to get into the jhanas. In particular, it deals with these nimittas, these lights, which I often talk about, this stage just before you get into jhanas. I know that some monks and others have asked, where does it actually say in the suttas about these nimittas? Where did the Buddha describe them? And probably the best place of all where he described them in detail is in this particular sutta, the Upekalesa Sutta. Because the Upekalesa, it means those very refined imperfections which are just there before you can get into the deep meditations called the jhanas. So it's specifically pointing to an aspect of meditation, a very fine aspect of meditation for those who really want to get deep into meditation. So it's a very profound sutta, but a very beautiful one, which I'm going to talk about today. So I'll just get my book out, and just those people who are waiting for a copy, there's a few more copies coming. Venerable Chunda is just bringing them out, so they'll be coming pretty soon. Here he comes with them now. So I'll just wait for him to come, and then we'll start with the Upekalesa Sutta. I know that sometimes people say that why do I teach such deep Dhamma, such teachings about nimittas when only a few people get these nimittas, but I found out that quite a lot of people get nimittas in their meditation, and it's very good to know exactly what happens when they occur and how to take them deeper. So if there's anyone who hasn't got a copy, could you please put your hand up again? We've got some more copies here. Anyone want a copy over there? Venerable Chunda? One over. Okay, never mind. Maybe you can sit next to Ainsley and Barbara or something. Oh, is there two there? No, that's it. Okay, have you got one, you two? You got? Okay. Okay, you okay with that one? Very good, that's the way. Okay. So we start off now. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So today we're talking of the 128th sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Upekalesa Sutta, concerning the ideal monastic community and the deep meditations at the stage of the nimittas. Thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. Now on that occasion the bhikkhus at Kosambi had taken to quarrelling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. So that was a time when there was an argument in the community in the city of Kosambi. It was a very famous argument, just on a trivial point of Vinaya, whether you should fill up the water bowl outside the toilet after you've used it, and when there's no water available anyway. And so there was a bit of a dispute there, but even worse than the point of Vinaya, the monastic rules, was the fact that the monks were making a big quarrel out of a small thing. Then a certain monk went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he stood at one side and said to the Buddha, Venerable Sir, the monks here at Kosambi have taken to quarrelling and brawling and are deep in dispute, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. It would be good, Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One would go to those monks out of compassion. The Blessed One consented in silence. It was usual in those days that if you wanted to get permission from a monk to do something, you ask him the question, and if the monks were silent, that was supposed to be an agreement. However, that doesn't count when you ask me a question. It may be I don't understand what you're talking about. So please don't think that being silent is consent. Then the Blessed One went to those bhikkhus and said to them, Enough, monks. Let there be no quarrelling, brawling, wrangling, or dispute. When this was said, a certain monk said to the Buddha, Wait, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One, the Lord of the Dhamma, live at ease, devoted to a pleasant abiding here and now. In other words, just meditate and get your jhanas. We are the ones who will be responsible for this quarrelling, brawling, wrangling, and dispute. In other words, he was saying, just butt out, Buddha, we'd call it today. This is our problem. You just go off and meditate. For a second time and for a third time, the Buddha said, Enough, monks, let there be no quarrelling, brawling, wrangling, or dispute. And for a third time, that monk said to the Blessed One, Wait, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One, the Lord of the Dhamma, live at ease, devoted to the jhanas. We are the ones who will be responsible for this quarrelling, brawling, wrangling, and dispute. So three times the monk sort of disrespected the Buddha, saying, No, you just get it, keep out of it. And so, with such disrespect, then when it was morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, entered the town of Kosambi for alms food. And when he had wandered for alms in Kosambi and had returned from his alms round, after his meal, he set his resting place in order, took his bowl and outer robe, and while standing uttered these stanzas before leaving. And so these are stanzas which we find in many other places, especially in the Dhammapada. And whether this was the first time they were said, or whether it was repeated from other occasions, we don't know. But some of these stanzas you hear here are the very, very famous verses from the Dhammapada. But first of all, the first two verses here, they're not found anywhere else. When many voices shout at once, none considers themselves a fool. Though the Sangha is being split, none thinks themselves to be at fault. They have forgotten thoughtful speech. They talk obsessed by words alone. Uncurbed their mouths, they bawl at will. None knows what leads him so to act. That would be a nice poem to read out in the parliaments of our world. Now we get to some of the very famous verses of the Buddha. He abused me, he struck me, he defeated me, he robbed me. In those who harbour thoughts like these, hatred will never be allayed. For in this world, hatred is never allayed by further acts of hate. It is allayed by non-hatred. This is the fixed and ageless law. It's one of the most oft-quoted stanzas of the Dhammapada. And it's also here in the Upakalesa Sutta. That's why that you've heard here many times it being said, it doesn't matter what someone has said to you, what they have done to you. If you keep those thoughts, then they are hurting you again. So we have no choice but to let these things go. They're in the past. Abandon them. Next stanza. Those others do not recognize that here we should restrain ourselves. But those wise ones who realize this at once end all their enmity. Breakers of bones and murderers, those who steal cattle, horses, or wealth, those who pillage the entire realm, when even these can act together, why can you not do so too? Talking to the group of quarrelling monks. If one can find one worthy friend, a virtuous, steadfast companion, then overcome all threats of danger and walk with him or her, content and mindful. But if one finds no worthy friend, no virtuous, steadfast companion, then just as a king leaves his conquered realm, walk like a tusker in the woods alone. Better it is to walk alone. There is no companionship with fools. Walk alone and do no evil, at ease like a tusker in the woods. So there was some verses of the Buddha about how to have some harmony when there is contention and disputes. Very beautiful little verses, especially how we have to let go of what was said to us or done to us. Otherwise, hatred will never be allayed. In the beginning, it's best to be restrained, and especially the way you use your words, not to forget thoughtful speech. And if one cannot find a worthy friend, then be alone. And that's exactly what the Buddha would do next. So, any questions or comments about that so far? Yes.
Ajahn, I mean, reading this stanza, my first question is, did the Buddha utter to just himself these stanzas, or to somebody those stanzas?
It's interesting to say how that could have been recorded if he was alone. It's quite likely that he told the story himself to his disciples at a later time, that he said that when he left, this is the stanzas which came to him to describe his feelings. It could have been that it was overheard just before he was leaving that he said this to other monks. But just after this time that he'd left, I'd imagine that being a Buddha, being a great teacher, it'd be very hard for him just to leave without seeing anybody. He would have probably told someone he was leaving and just mentioned these things to them.
And another question that leads to my mind, that comes to my mind is, I mean, those two groups of monks, could there be any Aryans there? Uh-huh. And they are quarreling like that? Could there be a dispute among the Aryans? Or yeah. Is this just a dispute among Putujanas?
Okay, it's a very good question. If it was the Arahats and the Anagamis, there would not be such disputes. Between the once returners and stream winners, there could be. It depends on which Aryans. But obviously, those who were the Arahats and the non-returners would be in the minority. So the majority, and even those Arahats, they might say, oh, come on, guys, you know, just put it together. Or they may just say, oh, just, this is too much for us, we're just going to be quiet. So there could have been, but there'd probably be the majority of them were just not Aryans. And for those of you who want to see the whole story of what happened there, there was in the Vinaya, they have the whole story. And it just shows you that in those days, the monks were just, many of them were just ordinary people. They weren't superheroes. They're just exactly like the monks today. The nuns were just exactly like the nuns today. So, and out of those monks, out of those nuns, came great teachers and great arahats, great meditators. So what it actually says is that, you know, the monks in those days are ordinary people. Yeah, they had their disputes over the most stupid of things. Just like in marriage, you have disputes over the most stupidest things. The big things you don't tend to dispute over, the small ones. And this was a small one, became a big argument. And for those who don't know the ending of that particular dispute, in the end, the monks could not settle the dispute themselves. And what happened was the lay community, they were just so fed up with their monks. And then especially the fact that they chased the Buddha away, the great teacher, that they met together and they decided, right, from now on, we're not giving the monks any more food. And so for the next few days, when the monks walked for alms round, they got absolutely nothing, not one grain of rice. And after a few days, the monks forgave each other and started living in harmony again. So that is the way the dispute was finished. Hitting the monks or the nuns where it really hurts in their tummies. So please, you know the power which you have. If there's any dispute in the sanghas in Perth, please don't feed us. We'll soon come to our senses out of desperation. Any other questions? Okay, now we get to the most perfect monastery. Oh, see, yeah, sorry. No, it has to be in the microphone. Okay, oh, no question. This goes on the internet throughout the world. Just to make you scared.
Could you explain this? This is the fixed and the ageless law. I mean, sometimes people use it eternal law, and I assume sometimes people use it nature. Is that how we are trying to say, like, the law of karma and all these things?
It is not a sort of sense of a law of karma. It's just the truth, which is ageless. Remember the idea of a law, that means it's legalistic. It's much better to call it a truth, a fixed and ageless truth. It's not a law of so much of karma. This is just the way things work in the world. And it's you know that from your own life. Every time that there has been some feeling, oh, they hurt me, they really gave me a hard time, then every time you keep thinking about that, the hatred never ceases. You have to let go of the past for hatred and ill will to cease. A lot of times people think, I can overcome that hatred and ill will by getting my own back, getting justice. They hurt me, I'm going to hurt them back twice over. But of course, you all know that hatred and the violence never ends that way. That is the ageless truth. So that's what the Buddha means. Okay, any other questions? Okay, let's get on to the most perfect monastery. Then, having uttered these stanzas while standing, the Buddha went to the village of Balakalonakara, which my Pali says is the village of the stupid salt makers. I don't know why that's called. Balaka means like stupid or unintelligent, and Lonakara is a salt maker. So I don't know where that village name came from. That was just an aside. On that occasion, the Venerable Bhagu was living in the village of Balakalonakara. When the Venerable Bhagu saw the Blessed One coming in the distance, he prepared a seat and set out water for washing the feet, which is the usual way of welcoming someone. Remember, people would not wear sandals, so you'd always wash the feet before they came into the house. The Blessed One sat down on the seat made ready and washed his feet. The Venerable Bhagu paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side, and the Blessed One said to him, I hope you are keeping well, monk. I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food. And that was the usual greeting which one monk would say to another. You know, just, I hope you're keeping well, in other words, good health. I hope you are comfortable and getting enough alms food. I am keeping well, Blessed One, I am comfortable, and I am not having any trouble getting alms food. Then the Blessed One instructed, urged, roused, and encouraged the Venerable Bhagu with a talk on the Dhamma, after which he rose from his seat and went to the Eastern Bamboo Park, which is the name of this particular monastery. Now, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuruddha, who was a cousin of the Buddha, the Venerable Nandiya, and the Venerable Kimbala were living at the Eastern Bamboo Park. The park keeper saw the Blessed One coming in the distance and told him, Do not enter this park, recluse. There are three clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them. So the monastery keeper was actually trying to protect those monks who were really, really devout meditators. He didn't recognize that this recluse coming in was none other than the Buddha. Many times people think the Buddha was somehow physically special, like super high with all these marks on his body. This is one other occasion which proves that the Buddha looked like any other monk, so much so that this park keeper just thought he was just a monk wandering into this monastery. They didn't realize that this was a Buddha. So please understand, the Buddha could not be distinguished from any other monk in the time of when he was alive. He didn't look particularly special. So the park keeper said, "Do not enter this park, recluse. There are three clansmen here seeking their own good. Do not disturb them." The venerable Aniruddha heard the park keeper speaking to the Blessed One and told him, "Friend, park keeper, don't keep the Buddha out. It's our teacher, the Buddha, who has come." Then the venerable Aniruddha went to the venerable Nandiya and the venerable Kimala and said, "Come out, come out, venerable sirs, come out. Our teacher, the Buddha, has arrived." Then all three went to meet the Blessed One. One took his bowl and outer robe, one prepared a seat, and one set out water for washing the feet. The Blessed One sat down on the seat, made ready, and washed his feet. Then those three venerable ones paid homage to the Blessed One and sat down at one side. And the Blessed One said to them, "I hope you are all keeping well, Aniruddha. I hope you are comfortable. I hope you are not having any trouble getting alms food." Just a little interesting point there, which comes up in other suttas. You see, he calls here, "I hope you're all getting well, Aniruddha." In the Pali language, if there's a whole group of monks, you address them all by the senior monk. So if you have a whole lot of monks, say, in Bodhinyana, and you want to talk to them all, you say, "I hope you're all getting well, Ajahn Brahm." And you mean all the monks. If you go over to Dharmasala, say, "I hope you're all doing well, Hasapanya," or Naroda. Who's the most senior? Hasa or Naroda? Hasa, okay. "Hope you're all getting well, keeping well, Hasapanya." And Hasapanya means Hasapanya, Naroda, and all the other nuns in that monastery. So when there is the leader of a group, and you just mentioned the leader of a well-known group, it means all the group. That's really important in places like the Satipatthana Sutta, where it says, having abandoned two of the hindrances, it also means the rest of that group, the whole five. By mentioning the leader, it's implied that all the others are also included. That's the idiom, these peculiarities in language. The whole Sangha, maybe five, six or seven monks, you address them all, "Hope you all get doing well, Brahma Wang Sos." So that's just the item there. "So I hope you're all keeping well, Aniruddha. I hope you are all comfortable. I hope you are not having trouble getting alms food." "We are keeping well, Blessed One. We are comfortable and we are not having any trouble getting alms food." That's the basic questions being answered. The Buddha continued, "I hope, Aniruddha, that you are all living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." I like the word mutual appreciation or mutual respect, because that's a key to harmony, respecting each other and not thinking that I am so superior to everybody else. So that was the question. Are you all living in concord with mutual respect, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes? "Surely, venerable sir, we are living in concord with mutual appreciation, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." "But, Aniruddha, how do you live like this?" "Venerable sir, as to that I think thus. It is a gain for me, it is a great gain for me, that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards his venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. And I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately." Remember, some of these monks had psychic powers, so when you think, what does it mean by open mental acts? It means people can understand what you're thinking. "I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, venerable sir, but one in mind." Then venerable Nandiya and the venerable Kimbala each spoke likewise, adding, "That is how, venerable sir, we are living in concord with mutual respect, without disputing, blending like milk and water, viewing each other with kindly eyes." Now that's, when I read that, that's how I would love to have monasteries, Buddhist societies, any communities, families, anyone living together, to maintain bodily acts of loving kindness, verbal acts, mental acts of loving kindness, both openly and in private. And then, of course, harmony comes. And, you know, that's possible. We aim for that. Now, what happens when you do have such harmony? Good, Anuruddha. I hope you all abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. Surely, Venerable Sir, we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. And how, Anuruddha, do you abide thus? Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whatever of us returns last, eats any food left over if he wishes, otherwise he throws it away where there is no greenery, or drops it in water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the water for drinking or for washing. He puts away the refuge bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty, he takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide, diligent, ardent, and resolute. And again, that just shows that, you know, whoever, it's no one's roster, you know, what to do. If you see something which needs to be done, you just do it. And if you need help, you just call someone over rather than having a conversation about it. And this idea of every 5 days, those monks would meet together and just discuss Dhamma, that used to be the standard in the Old Forest monasteries. There never used to be any formal meetings, only maybe 4 or 5 days, maybe longer, maybe shorter. The bell would be rung and the monks would meet together and the Dhamma talk would be given. Now, if there was everyone was doing well, there'd be few Dhamma talks. If there was a problem, then more Dhamma talks would be given. So there was this beautiful sense of irregularity. Whenever it was needed, it would happen. And this sense of people helping each other. So you never need to say, it's your turn, you do it. No, I did it last week, it's your turn. There was never any of that. It was a sake of like peace and harmony and helping each other. And that's why I see that. I thought, wow, I wish I was in a monastery like that. And I tried to make one like that. Any comments or questions? Okay, let's go further. Good, Anuruddha. But while you abide thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. See, this is what diligent, ardent, and resolute means. It doesn't mean, right, I'm going to really go for it. Right, I'm going to sit for hours and hours and hours. It's like being diligent and resolute in the way that you practice, especially with your metta, kindness towards one another, and restraint. There is a question just before we go on to the next part. So whoever's got the microphone goes over there.
I was just wondering, in terms of the amount of people in a monastery, in this case there are three, are there other instances in the suttas that a group lives harmoniously with a larger number, or what is the recommended number of people in a community by the Buddha?
There's no recommended number by the Buddha. There are monasteries that have a huge number of monks. There's those with a small number of monks like this. And some of those monasteries which had a huge number of monks, they would still live off in the forest by themselves for most of the time and only come together, you know, maybe just once every few days. So even though there was a lot of monks staying in a monastery such as, you know, around Rajagaha, they were living in solitude for most of the day. It's wonderful to see such a situation is also happening in places like Sri Lanka, where Venerable Nisarana, who's one of our monks, who just recently came back, I went to visit where he was staying. He has this very old cave hut, many hundreds of years old, which he stays in. It's been renovated. And he stays there for about 10 or 11, 12 days by himself, goes on alms round in the village, doesn't really see any other monks. When it comes down to the moon days, you know, twice a month, and he goes to this much more... like a well-appointed vihara, with all the other monks in the area. They do the Patimokkha recitation. He fills up with any medicines he needs or any supplies like toilet paper. And you know, there's internet access there, so if he needs to do any business, he can do the business. And then after a couple of days staying there, he goes back to stay in solitude again. And that was actually almost ideal, just have hermits which stay for most of the fortnight alone, and then one or two days they come to a big monastery where they can get all of their requisites and just make sure they're okay, and then they go off for another sort of 12 or 13 days by themselves. So that means you can have lots of monks, but most of the day, most of the week, you're by yourself. So, now this is what happens when, I say, you dwell diligent, ardent, and resolute. It's not superhuman effort. It's just the restraint and kindness. Good, good, Aniruddha. But while you abide thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, have you attained any superhuman states, distinctions in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones, a comfortable abiding? Now, those superhuman states, again, this is the Pali language. That means states of jhana, some of the supernormal powers based on those jhanas, and also the stages of enlightenment. But in particular, it means the jhanas and stream meaning once returning, non-returning, or arahat. And he answers thus, Venerable Sir, as we abide here diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive both light and vision of forms. Soon afterwards, the light and vision of forms disappear, but we have not discovered the cause for that. That is not the best translation of the Pali, so I will retranslate it for you. Venerable Sir, as we abide here diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive the light and the forms. Soon afterwards, the light and forms disappear. We have not mastered that nimitta. The word there is nimitta. And I mention that because a lot of times people say, where is nimittas? Where is nimittas in the Pali? And sometimes the English translation just misses it. It's nimitta pati vijamati. So vijamati means to really master with understanding. We haven't mastered and understood those nimittas. So here the light, the vision of forms, that is the nimittas it's referring to. The Pali makes that very clear. So Venerable Sir, as we abide here diligent, ardent, and resolute, we perceive the light and the forms, which is the nimitta, but soon afterwards it disappears. We have not really comprehended that nimitta. And the Buddha said, you should master that nimitta, not discover the cause for that. We should master that nimitta. Aniruddha, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too perceived both light and those forms. Soon afterwards, the light and those forms disappeared. I thought, what is the cause and the condition why the light and the vision of forms disappeared? Then I considered thus. Doubt arose in me, and because of the doubt, my stillness fell away. Again, I don't like using the word concentration. That is a bad translation. Doubt arose in me, and because of the doubt, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the forms disappeared. I shall so act that doubt will not arise in me again. When that nimitta arises in the meditation, that light which disappears, and sometimes it makes a particular form, that particular form, as I've mentioned many times, the best form is a very simple form. In other words, just a beautiful single light, like a moon or like a sun. However, if it is complex, like seeing a whole landscape, that still counts as a nimitta. That's the perception of forms, that's the light. But that is not so useful, as will come clear afterwards. But it, as a meditation teacher, I don't know how many times when people see the first nimitta, they come up and say, no, it couldn't have been a nimitta. I was seeing the sunrise, the headlights of a car were shining in my face, or they say something like that. It's amazing how many times when a nimitta first comes up, people have doubt. And to overcome that doubt, this is my personal experience as a teacher. When people come up and they ask me a question, I saw this light, was it an nimitta or was it a flashlight or was it something else? 99% of the time, it's a nimitta. A real nimitta, I know what I'm talking about. So if these lights appear in your mind, give yourself the 99-to-1 benefit of the doubt, it was a nimitta. But sometimes it's really interesting. Why is it that people doubt that? It is. So the first upakalesa, the first of these deep imperfections which comes up is doubt as to what you're experiencing. Number two of the upakalesas. As Anuruddha, I was abiding, diligent, ardent and resolute, I perceived the light and the forms. Soon afterwards, the light and forms disappeared. I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and the forms have disappeared? I considered thus, inattention arose in me. And because of inattention, my concentration fell away. Or sorry, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and visions and forms disappeared. I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention will rise in me again. A lot of the times, the inattention is solved by just the sheer power and beauty of that form. So we actually do naturally pay attention to it without any need of force. Other times, the reason why we're inattentive to the nimitta is because we've got stuck into our head that we should be watching the breath. So instead of allowing the natural course of meditation to evolve and we just become this observer who doesn't interfere with the process, a light appears in our mind and we say, no, I should take my attention away from the light and put it on back to the breath, which is another cause for taking the attention away from the nimitta. Right advice is that if a light appears in the mind, what should you do? Nothing. Let the mind decide what it wants. So usually it will stay with the nimitta, but if that nimitta really is not strong enough, the mind will go back to the breath by itself. It's not your fault, this is just nature. You don't do anything. But it's inattention now, when a lot of times we just push our mind away from the nimitta, and usually it's onto the breath. Any questions so far? Yes.
Light and form.
Please use the microphone.
Light and form.
To your mouth.
It is. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Light and form. Oh.
Yeah. Good.
Like you see, inattention is, I mean, attention should be a natural thing if we let it be. But what if the form is in the form of colour? It's
form
really colour.
Of...
There's no landscape. There's nothing. And it's colour and there's brightness. Of course, objective is brightness as you say, let it grow to bright. But if there's this colour that is growing colourful, how the mind is... You can't decide. You get distracted if you go into attention, like colour, like...
Indeed. That doesn't mean what attention is. What we're really doing there is if you see sort of like a colour... Now look, a common nimitta is a spread of colour, like a whole screen with light. That is like a light which hasn't got really much forms at all. There's no shapes, there's no individual contours of images. It's just a spread of light. Now, that's fine. That's the beginning of the nimittas. It counts as a nimitta. You're seeing the light. The perception of forms really hasn't developed yet. That comes later. And again, a lot of times, the way I suggest which works is actually to do a little thing, which is pay attention to the brightest part of that screen of light. you'll always see that that screen of light is not uniform, it's not even. There's some parts which are dull, some parts which are brighter. Paying attention to the parts which are brighter means the mind will go in there, the bright parts will expand and get stronger, and the nimittas which have a form will start to appear. So if you see a red colour, which you were saying, and it hasn't got much form to it, leave it alone. It will eventually find a form by itself. If you want to hasten the process, just pay attention to the most beautiful part of that red colour, and that part will just grow, become usually a nice circular nimitta.
Can I?
Yes, please. Come back.
What is this form? Okay.
A form is like a shape, an image. So the difference between like a spread of light, that's formless. You know, when you see an image, it could be a person, a tree, it could be a ball, it could be a moon, it could be a lake or anything like that. That is like the form.
So I just want to clarify, because I think too much reading is getting into the way of meditation. I mean, and reading of Nama Rupa is the worst thing that happened, because it just throw the whole thing out. So this form, the Nama Rupa, that I take it as what you say, the Nama Rupa, which is the object of consciousness, the sixth sense consciousness. So I want to drop this. If I can talk light and form without Nama Rupa, I'm happy. But now I start to realize color is not a form. It's not a classification of form.
Remember, all these words mean different things in different contexts, just like the English language. So in this particular context, I think I've described it pretty accurately. It's the particular form here is just that particular form where things take shape. The difference between sort of a coloured screen where there's no shape, no images other than just a spread of colour, until you see people or trees or hills or stars or lakes or something. That's what we mean by forms.
Can I just finish off just to understand a bit of this? I mean, this is something new to me, to understand form and formless. Just to finish it, then when people start to talk about form, loka, rupa loka and arupa loka.
That's again a different context. So that's a different...
From this concept of getting the nimitta into jhana.
That's right, that's totally different. So let's put that one aside for another time. So it's using rupa in another context. Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. So that was the first two things which destroyed that nimitta. The first one, of course, was the doubt, and the second one was inattention. As Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, ardent, and resolute. I perceived both light and form. Soon afterwards, the light and forms disappeared. I thought, what is the cause and condition why the light and forms disappeared? Then I considered thus. It was sloth and torpor arose in me. Because of sloth and torpor, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the forms disappeared. I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor will arise in me again. And of course, you all know the sloth and torpor is just that tiredness. The best way to overcome that tiredness, especially if you do see a nimitta, is to get that nimitta to be bright. Soon it's so bright that you cannot have sloth and torpor. Your mind becomes energized. Sometimes people get these nimittas through force. They do put forth effort. You can achieve these nimitta stages through force, but by that time the mind is tired. You let go a little bit, you just fall asleep. In other words, you've wasted your energy. If you can get to that nimitta stage through the most efficient method, which is letting go, letting go, letting go, and allow the mind to become still, when the nimittas arise, then very rarely do you have any problem with sloth and torpor. As Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, ... I considered thus. Now these are the nice ones. Fear arose in me, and because of fear my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the forms disappeared. Suppose a man set out on a journey, and murderers leaped out on both sides of him. Then fear would arise in him because of that. So too, fear arose in me. The light and the forms disappeared. I consider thus, I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor nor fear will arise in me again. Now this tells me that this is almost a sequence of defilements of the nimitta, starting off with the doubt, which is usually the first one which arises, and that's what I've seen when I've talked to people, and then inattention, and then sloth and torpor. This shows that that nimitta is now becoming established, that light is becoming strong, and it so often happens that people do get afraid because it starts to get powerful. And these nimittas do get very, very powerful, and it can sometimes scare the pants off you. It's how can I handle something as strong as this? There's also another reason why there is fear, and this is why the Buddha used the simile of murderers. Why are you afraid of murderers? Is because they're going to take what is most precious to you, your life, away from you. What you find is being taken away from you in these nimittas is your ability to control. These nimittas are so powerful that basically you realize you're totally out of control. These things are much more strong than you are. And that is scary when you first come across a nimitta. Huge power, which you can't control. Remember, this whole path is about letting go. It starts with letting go. The whole middle part of it is letting go of this controlling and will and doing things. And the end of it is realizing there was no one here to begin with, to realize, yes, there is nothing here. Begins with letting go, it ends with letting go. And so this is scary because it's like something you really, really cherish. Your ability to control is being taken away from you. Or rather, to be more accurate, being revealed, you never control to begin with. That was a myth, that was an illusion. And you're looking through that. And that is scary. The most important part of you, your ability to control things, is being seen for what it truly is, an illusion. And that is often scary. But the way to overcome that, the way to act so that neither doubt nor inattention nor sloth and torpor nor fear will arise in me again. Two ways. Well, let's say three ways. The first way is actually to listen to a monk like me, which you've known for many years, which you can trust. Say, look, I've been there, been through that, and you've got nothing to be afraid of. It's all going to be very good fun. It's par for the course. When you realize, it's not just me being afraid, it's par for the course, this is just what happens when you get to these stages of meditation. That takes away a lot of the fear. You get confidence in the path because, you've had a good teacher and you trust that teacher. I say, there's nothing wrong, you're going to be fine, you can have the time of your life. Usually I say the time of many lives. Go for it. So first of all, it's like the confidence. Because, you have good teachers who encourage you to go for it. The second way of overcoming that fear is the old simile of taking the child to the swimming pool for the first time. The child has just learned to stand on dry land, and now you take it to this stuff which you can't even stand on, this liquid called water. And, of course, the kid will be terrified. So how do you don't throw the kid in the water and just scare the life out of it. You put the kid's toe in the water and take it out again. Oh, that was okay. Then you put the foot in. Oh, that was nice. Then you put the leg in and take it out. That didn't hurt. And once the kid gradually learns to get confidence with the water, then the kid can immerse his whole body in the water. And as you know, I love this simile because as soon as you put your kid in the water, you can't get it out again because it's too much fun. They're having a great time. Splashing around and playing. That's just like with this nimitta. Yeah, it's fearful at first. Just go a little bit further and come back again. Next time, a little bit further and come back again. A little bit further. And when you really get into it, it's hard to come out. And it's almost impossible to come out. You're having too much fun. Which gives rise to the third way of overcoming this fear, which is just the sheer fun of it. You know what it's like, growing up There's certain pleasures in life which people say are bad for you. You go blind, you get into trouble, you get pregnant, you do all this other stuff. But you know, people try and make you afraid of, you know, enjoying the pleasures of the world. But what do you do when you're young? Yeah, I'm afraid, but you know, it's good fun, so let's go for it. You take risks because of the pleasure. And this is the third way. And I must admit, it's the way which I overcame these fear things. It was just too much fun. I couldn't... What the hell, I'm going for it. And that's what you do. It's just so much enjoyable, so much joy at this stage of meditation. You just can't resist it. I'm just going for it. Who cares what happens? So those are the three ways of overcoming the fear. And when I say this is the interesting one, because this is one of the two big ones which stops you getting into the jhanas, which stops the nimitta developing, the fear. And the underlying reason for the fear is you're out of control, you can't do anything, and you know that. And if you haven't let go before, that scares you. But go for it. It's good fun. It's what meditation's about, learning how to be confident that you can let go and things go much, 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 much better than they've ever done when you're controlling and calling the shots. So that's one of the big of the defilements. The other big one comes next. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, I consider thus. Elation arose in me, and because of elation, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms vanished. Suppose a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure came all at once upon five entrances to hidden treasure. Then elation would arise in him because of that. So too elation arose in me. The light and the vision of forms disappeared. I consider thus, I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention, nor sloth and torpor, nor fear, nor elation will arise in me again. Now this is the elation, the excitement. Ah yes, something's happening at last. Woohoo, here we go. Now Ajahn Brahm's talked about this. I've read this in the suttas. It's happening to me. This beautiful light. Wow, at last. Some of you have been waiting for years for this. Meditating for so long, so many retreats, and at last, here it is. Yeah! That's called elation. What I call the wow response. And of course, as soon as you say wow, that beautiful nimitta just goes away and doesn't come back again for months. Be careful. When I read this sutra, I thought, wow, this Buddha, he really knew what he was talking about. Because you come across these things yourself. And those are the two big ones to be mindful of. The fear and the excitement, the elation. The uh-oh or the wow. Here we go. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, I consider thus. Inertia arose in me. And because of inertia, my concentration fell away. When my concentration fell away, the light and the visions of forms vanished. Sorry, let's go back to that because I mentioned the word concentration. Because I'm trying to sort of get out of that habit of concentration. That really is the wrong translation for samadhi. Samadhi means stillness. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, I considered thus. Inertia arose in me, and because of inertia, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that all these other things and inertia does not arise in me again. Now, the inertia is a very good stab by Bhikkhu Bodhi of the word dutalang. It literally means like heaviness. And it's like that nimitta is a bit heavy and not enough lightness. Again, that would happen if you got to that nimitta stage through effort. The nimitta is not light and flimsy. No, not flimsy. What's the right word? It's basically it's too heavy, too solid, too. No, sorry. Buoyancy is a very good word for it, but you can see just the heaviness of it. The inability to allow it to evolve, that heaviness, which is an effective quality of the nimitta. If you experience that, you know what they're talking about here. It's the stiffness of it. That's a good word. The stiffness of the nimitta. Now you can't understand, how can you say something is stiff when it's this light in the mind? But again, that these are realms which few people have, especially in the Western world, have experienced, and so we don't have a full language developed for these nimitta stages. But buoyancy, lack of buoyancy, stiffness, those are the sorts of words which somehow describe this feeling. And again, I would say one of the best ways of avoiding that is, again, the way you arrive at that nimitta to begin with a nice lightness of touch in your meditation, kindness and gentleness. Then when a nimitta arises, it's very light, very, very buoyant, to use your word. Ah, through sloth and torpor. Is a sloth and torpor is when in that hard nimitta, the lack of softness in it, you're aware of it, but you just can't progress. Sloth and torpor, you lose your mindfulness. You just dull out. So here, you still have that nimitta, but you can't go further with it. It's stuck there because it's stiff, heavy, because the way you came into it.
What's the seed cause of that stiffness? What's the seed cause of that stiffness? Is it control or rigidity?
Again, it is control. Control also comes from fear, from holding things too hard. It's the lack of gentleness in the meditation.
Thanks.
Remember when I keep saying, and it's on the back of the T-shirts issued at Jhana Grove, make peace, be kind, be gentle. This is not something I made up. That is just a translation of the second factor of the Eightfold Path, right thought or right intention. Especially number three, the gentleness. Too much aggression, I would say, is one of the main causes for getting a stiff nimitta. Next one, number 22. As Anuruddha was abiding diligent, I consider thus. Excessive energy arose in me, and because of excessive energy, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. Suppose a man were to grip a quail, a tiny bird, tightly with both hands, it would die then and there. So to an excess of energy arose in me, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I consider thus, I shall so act that neither doubt nor intention nor all these other things nor an excess of energy will arise in me again. Now the word for the energy is the virya. It's almost like the excess of effort. And the simile of the Buddha gives the meaning better than I could. Just you're holding something too tight. You've got a nimitta and basically you're too afraid it might disappear. So it's got one, you hold it there, rather than just letting it be and letting it develop. If you hold a quail, is a very small bird, a very fragile bird. And I think the simile here is these nimittas at that stage are quite fragile. So you've just got to hold it very, very lightly, and then it will develop. But if you hold it with force, just like holding a quail with force, trying to hold the nimitta rather than letting the nimitta be, then that is the defilement. It's common that happens to people because they spend such a lot of time developing all the meditation till they get the nimitta. Once they got it, they don't want to lose it. Because they don't want to lose it, they hold it too tightly and then they lose it. Yeah. So again, just that very gentleness of touch is what's needed. Go on.
Ajahn, implied in what you say is the ability to be able to trust at that point. Trust in, I'm not quite sure what, but trust.
Okay,
and a lot of us have difficulties in trust.
Remember, the opposite of trust is fear and control, which comes from that fear. Trust is part of letting go. Trust, one of the ways of overcoming the trust is having faith. Faith in the teacher and the teachings. Now, this is why I teach like this. This is why I encourage people to come to these sutta classes. So after a while, you know, you've known me for a long time. You know that sort of, you know, as I speak, so I practice. You've sussed me out before you've come here. And after a while, if you have faith in these teachings, That gives you the trust. Okay, the teacher which I trust says, I can let this go, I don't need to hold it, and it will stay. And you give it a go, and it works. So having trust in a guide means that you know that they're going to take you on the right path when you go up in the mountains where you've never been before. You trust them. And the other part of that faith is the experience. You know, you've done enough to get to Nimittas where you have trusted in the process, you haven't made it happen, you've let go. It's worked up to here. Why not carrying on, letting go? And that experience, yeah, this is the path, this has worked so far. I'm not going to change the main way I'm meditating now. And then you find that that is the path and that takes you deeper. Yeah.
Just want to clarify on this excessive energy. You use it as the effort during meditation, seeing the nimitta.
Yes.
But what if, I'm not trying to clarify, if it is energy that we wanted even before, way before all these things, it's a natural energy of the mind that, because with natural energy, natural joy, natural brightness, all come into a cycle. But if you're at nimitta state, and you somehow, sometime, you got so much energy of the mind, you call it. Now, this energy of mind has nothing to do with effort because it just comes from a...
Exactly, yes.
But then if it's so much energy in the mind, when you go back to the next sitting or more sitting, you are not alert because your mindfulness is not there yet. It's a kind of course, you can say, take skill, take time. But I think somehow it just doesn't click in my understanding.
That's why, the translation of energy is not a very good translation. That's why I use the word effort rather than energy for this particular context. So too much effort rather than too much energy, because I agree with you. There can't be too much energy in that stage of meditation. The energy is powerful, but it's a focused energy. It's a still energy. But the thing is, the effort is what makes it wobble. So I agree with you there. I think the translation here is confusing. Energy will not be the right word. Effort would be a much better word. And the simile which the Buddha uses of holding a quail would be the indicator that, yes, that's what we mean.
I have to spend more on the question because this is a meditation sutta, and I think it's good to just clarify the wordings and the practice. Now, I understand this effort in this nimitta, which is okay, but what to do if your natural energy or mind is so good after meditation, but it's not good enough to carry on more proper sitting because the mindfulness is just not there, it just wears you out. I don't know how to explain.
Okay, when you have lots and lots of energy after meditation, what's a very good thing is to remember just to make peace, be kind, be gentle, make peace, be kind, be gentle, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Then that will preserve that energy. And it will stop it becoming almost like destructive, to your peace, to your harmony. Intense, but peaceful.
But you can be very sure that the physical energy, there's a tiredness around the whole...
Not at all, no tiredness, because that's if the energy has actually done too much work. It's been dissipated, then it can be tiredness. But if you keep it focused, keep it still, then the energy will not tire you. You'll be at rest at night without really falling to sleep. But as long as you're not worried about falling asleep, you're at peace with that, you're kind to it, you're gentle with it, there's no problem at all. The trouble is when we try and control that energy. If we try and control that energy by, I don't want it this way, I want it that way, that is usually where we get the problems. So just make peace with it. Be kind, be gentle. Be the energy.
I just finished, But I guess it's through experience and through... Yeah. I mean, which person have different way of doing things. But it's just energy. Okay, you learn to let go until this stage. But if you can't handle it properly, you just can't get the mindfulness to... Not that you want the next session to be a payday session, but it's not easy to cope.
Yeah. But I think that I'll go back to the beginning of this sutta. It's to be ardent, diligent and resolute. that came from those monks training in this basic kindness towards each other, this basic restraint, you know, of speech towards each other, and that sort of harmoniousness towards, you know, the people they live with and their surroundings. By developing that basis in what was really a really good virtue, that to me is much more important. You know, the way we speak, you know, the kindness in which we act, that's a basis of all virtue. When that was so strong in these monks, then when energy arose, they can handle it. So to handle that excess energy, just have more restraint in your daily life. Speak less, be more kind, and develop more harmony. And then if you can do that with people, it's very easy to have a sense of harmony, restraint and peace with these powerful nimittas. I've got to be... Okay, one more question and we move on, yeah?
Ajahn, just the flip side of that, as you're doing this training in deeper levels of meditation and energy, is that likely to precipitate a lot of uncovering of hidden neuroses and your hidden hang-ups or whatever? You, at one level, I thought I was a really relaxed and together kind of guy, and then I go into deep energy experiences and I realise I see things myself that I didn't even imagine. Is it possible that the deepening or the increase in energy flushes that stuff out of you? And so it doesn't go both ways, you know. Morality supports depth in meditation. Does energy in meditation, if it's centered energy, flush out and cause a person to be more generous, more pure, more, you know, nice to their fellow human beings?
I believe that's quite correct. It's just like, you know, it's very easy to be a second monk when you're the top monk, you know, that reveals many of the defilements or attachments which you just don't notice when you're not in a position of power. The same with meditation, when you've got more energy, to be able to deal with that high energy, then you see some of the faults in your character which you won't see when you're not put in that position. So it's that high energy, to be able to deal with it, it takes a little bit more learning. Whenever you sort of change your position in the world, go up the corporate ladder or whatever else you're doing, you find at every stage it's a learning process. You see things which weren't there before. It demands another test which you have to pass. So that's one way of looking at these deep meditations. To go on to the next stage of meditation, you have to pass the test. There's some sort of test of character, some test of letting go, some test of understanding which you have to pass before you get on to the next stage. So here's how to deal with immense energy. Yeah, it does sort of reveal some things you haven't seen before. Shine lights into the dark corners of your mind. But it's not that hard. It's best to shine the light up there as soon as you possibly can, because it's there. Get rid of the dust.
And would you say that the level of energy that we're talking about here is much bigger than sexual orgasm?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. I made that comment somewhere recently, I forget where, and somebody took me to task. And quite rightly, I agree with them there. They said, you know, you keep on saying that these energies and blisses are better than sexual orgasm. By saying that, you're putting them in the same league. They say, look, they don't deserve to be in the same league, to be spoken about in the same breath. You know, the sexual pleasure is one thing, and these amazing energies and blisses which come from meditation are in a totally different sort of league. So I said, yes, I agree with you, but I only do that because I want to talk in people's language to give them some idea, even an imperfect idea of what these stages of meditation are like. I agree with you. Here we go. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, I consider thus, deficiency, let's call it effort, deficiency of effort arose in me. And because the deficiency of effort, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and vision of forms disappeared. Suppose a man were to grip a quail loosely, it would fly out of his hands. So a deficiency of effort arose in me. The light and vision of forms vanished. I consider thus, I shall so act that neither doubt nor inattention nor these other things, nor an excess nor deficiency of this effort will arise in me again. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, I consider thus, longing arose in me. And because of that longing, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms vanished. I shall so act that night these other things and longing will not arise in me again. Now, I mentioned the two big ones, the fear and excitement. This is just behind those two big ones, the longing, the wanting. And I've used that so often in my meditation. You get stuck somewhere, what do I want? And you get so skilled at seeing that longing, that slight wanting, that stops progress in the meditation. You know, you get so close, you get this beautiful nimitta, I want the jhanas. Fool, idiot, you know, you've blown it. Even the slightest piece of longing, just disturbs the tranquility. The mind moves, it starts to wobble. So longing is, you know, you've got so far because you've been content in the moment, being at peace with things, and then you long for something which is tiny, the slightest bit of wanting disturbs the peace. So contentment, which is the opposite of longing. Look, you got to a nimitta, brilliant state of mind. Isn't that enough for you? I mean, for most people, they just, you're pissing out on this happiness which is, you know, way above sexual orgasm. Isn't that enough? Why do you keep wanting more? So I just say, this is enough for me. If you say, this is enough for me, then you get more. If you say, I want more, then you lose everything you've even just got. So be careful of longing, wanting, even the slightest bit of I want the next stage. You've blown it. As Anuruddha, I was abiding diligent, and I considered thus. This is another one I like. Perception of diversity arose in me. And because of perception of diversity, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that neither doubt nor intention nor these other things, nor perception of diversity will arise in me again. Now, what this refers to is sometimes, I mentioned this because I talked to someone this morning, that they got these beautiful nimittas, but it was these scenery, you know, very beautiful fields, or even like mansions with, you know, deva-like people inside of them. Very blissful, very wonderful, having a great time, but far too diverse. To be able to take these nimittas to the next stage, it has to have a unity of perception. Even just seeing, you know, that, but I keep on mentioning that disc nimitta, you know, where you just see like a moon or like a flashlight, like a car headlight in the darkness, just a single light, single colour, and a sort of a simple shape. And that means you're getting out of diversity. And I did once read in the Visuddhimagga that when you get these nimittas, you should, you know, notice what shape they are and expand them and move them around and contract them. And I thought that was really, really bad advice. Because as soon as you try and notice, is this circular, is this oblong, is this a star, whatever, straight away you're seeing the inside and the outside, which defines its shape. You're getting to a duality, a diversity of perception, which is why that I train myself when a nimitta arises. If it's a complicated nimitta, in other words, a scenery, you see people, you see this perception of forms, like landscapes or whatever, then, as I mentioned on Saturday afternoon, you find the most beautiful part of that scenery. I remember once having a nimitta of like landscape and then going to one tree where there was like a dewdrop on one leaf which sparkled, and focusing my mind just on that sparkle and that little twinkle. And I almost did this, you know, because maybe past lives of, you know, training before. And straight away you go to that twinkle, bang, then the big nimitta comes up. The real ones, you know, the simple ones. There's always some little twinkle, some little beautiful part of the diverse mental images. If you train yourself to actually to go for that, then from that comes a very powerful, simple nimitta. With no diversity at all. So perception of diversity means that if you have the complicated nimitta, turn it into a simple one through that method I just taught. Or when it becomes like a light, don't concern yourself with the edges of that that limiter. It doesn't matter whether it's square or round, go to its center. In the same way you watch the TV, after a while you can't see the edges of the screen. You don't know whether it's a wooden frame or an aluminium frame. You're right inside that TV. Go to the center. Because in the center of that limiter, of that light, that's when there is no more diversity. Okay. And number 26. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, I consider thus. Excessive meditation. What a terrible translation that is. Is excessive reflecting upon forms arose in me. So a long time ago I corrected my version here, reflecting upon forms arose in me. You know, the word meditating in the West, you know, means thinking about something. I'm meditating on the contract I'm doing in my company. It means like reflecting, okay. So we use meditation in a totally different context. Excessive reflecting upon the forms arose in me. And because of excessive reflecting upon forms, my stillness fell away. When my stillness fell away, the light and the vision of forms disappeared. I shall so act that these other things, nor the excessive reflection upon forms, will arise in me again. So again, this is when we get really, really still. Things are happening, and we just make this reflection. Now, even this, what is this? What should I do? Now, this is a nimitta, or what is it? That sort of little bit of commentary, even though it is subverbal often, that little bit of thought which wants to describe or experience, or like take that mental photograph of it so you can remember it afterwards, that little bit of mental effort disturbs. So you have to be still, leave things alone. You will remember it afterwards. You don't need to take notes, because in these stages of meditation your mind is very powerful. Because it's powerful, it's easy to remember. Just you be like the scientist collecting the data, and afterwards when you come out, then you can do all your reflecting on what it was, what it meant.
So if your meditation in let's say in retreat time, where you got a lot of quiet sitting, so, and you happen to be doing a lot of getting into nimitta for short period or long period, it doesn't matter. But what if doing this kind of sitting where you, because you're at nimitta state, everything is so sensitive, any slight movement of your mind doing anything, it just can throw the thing out if it's not still or bright. But what if the mind is thinking about, not thinking even, just a slight touch of going to the breath, going to more bright or more colour, just even more colour or more bright, the kind of just that you watch out that it came out, everything is just thrown off.
That's right, yes.
But it has nothing to do with you, because your will is actually, you're actually an observer, but it all happened and you're seeing all these things happening. What can you do?
A lot of time we think that we never did anything, this thing just happened, it disappeared by itself. I never pointed out, but in this sutta, the Buddha said, what was the cause, the condition for these things happening? So when you come out afterwards, what was the cause, what was the condition, you know, for that particular state of meditation to fall apart, or for that thought, or for that movement of the mind to happen? So you investigate, what is the cause, what is the condition? And if it's a nimitta state, you'll find it's one of these things which we just talked about. This is why the Buddha gave this checklist in this upakalesa. It doesn't happen by itself. It's one of these causes or conditions we just mentioned.
The way I see it, really need a teacher to just, especially on this kind of stage, because the mind just go into...
The mind can very easily get lost. That's why we have teachings. That's why the Buddha gave this incredibly beautiful sutta. Focus just on that part of the meditation, the nimitta stage, and just what happens and why. So if you have the nimittas during a retreat and then something happens, take a copy of this sutta with you and just check which one was it. And then when you actually see these ones, you usually find out, that was what it was. And once you know the cause, it's not that hard to find an antidote to that cause. And even though in this sutta they never give the antidotes, but I was giving the antidotes from my experience.
Just to finish, because I don't want to... Yeah. Because this is a man. I think the problem, the way I see... I haven't got a chance to talk to a lot of people, and I don't believe in just talking. Is this question of this form, this rupa, and if people don't get it right, or if for my situation, I stop reading for a long, long time and try to read a bit again, it get really all thrown up, because what we are doing is using even the breath, the simplest form, and yet with all this kind of, I'm not honest, not that it's just very difficult to, you see, yes, you bring the book along, but only today I understand what you mean by color is not form and all this.
Very good. Well, this is why we keep teaching, right? It's just good to keep coming. And eventually, through patience, everybody gets there. Okay, I've got to keep going on. Number 28. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, ardent and resolute. I perceive the light, but not the forms. I saw the forms, but not perceived the light. Even for a whole night or a whole day, or a whole day and night, I thought, what is the cause and condition for this? Then I considered thus. On the occasion when I do not attend to the nimitta of forms, but attend to the nimitta of light, then I perceive light, but I do not see forms. On the occasion when I do not attend to the nimitta of light, but attend to the nimitta of forms, then I see the forms, but not perceive the light, even for a whole day or a whole day and night. As Aniruddha, I was abiding diligent, ardent and resolute, I perceived limited light and saw limited forms. I perceived immeasurable light and saw immeasurable forms. Even for a whole day or a whole night, or a whole day and night, I thought, what is the cause and condition for this? Then I considered thus, on the occasion when the stillness is limited, my vision is limited. With limited vision, I perceive limited light and limited form. On an occasion when my stillness is immeasurable, my vision is immeasurable, and with immeasurable vision, I perceive immeasurable light and see immeasurable forms, even for a whole day and a whole night. Now, especially that last practice, that last paragraph, 29, it is the stillness and the depth of that stillness which creates the power and the immeasurableness of those limiters, the sheer intensity of that light. The more still you are, the more powerful that light is. And I have to mention that somebody told me this during a recent meditation retreat I gave somewhere, and I said, yep, I understand exactly what you're talking about, because it happened to me. But sometimes the limiter gets so incredibly strong that, and this is early years as a meditator, I thought, my God, I'm going to go blind. It's like looking at the sun. You go outside now and look directly at the sun, you think, you can't keep looking at something so bright and so intense. And it becomes incredibly intense. And obviously, in the stupidity of a young meditator, you know, you're not seeing a real light. This is a mental image. And the mind doesn't go blind. You can take whatever intensity is offered to you. The more intense, the more bright, the more immeasurable is that intensity, the better it is. So you don't need to be afraid. When that nimitta gets incredibly bright, brighter than the sun, 1,000 times brighter than the sun, the mind can take it. It can take more as well. There's no limit. It's immeasurable. And it's the reason why it gets very, very strong is because you have been very still, perfectly still. It's the stillness which gives the mind the energy. Build up many hours of stillness, and the mental energy, instead of going off into doing things, you know, that two halves of the mind, the doer and the knower, instead of wasting its energy on doing things, it just knows, and the intensity goes into the knowing. That's when the mind gets incredibly bright. Doing means you're wasting energy. And I've mentioned that many times before. Okay, number 30 is just summing everything up. When Aniruddha, I understood that doubt is an upikalesa, an imperfection of the mind, and had abandoned that doubt, which was an imperfection of the mind. When I understood that inattention is an imperfection of the mind, sloth and torpor, fear, elation or excitement, this stiffness of the nimitta, this excess of force, deficiency of effort, abandoned longing, abandoned a perception of diversity, abandoned reflection upon these forms. Then I thought, I have abandoned those imperfections of the mind. Let me now develop the stillness in the three ways. Thereupon, Anuruddha, I developed the stillness with movement of the mind onto the object and holding the object. I developed stillness without movement of the mind on the object, but holding the object only. I developed stillness without movement of the mind onto the object, nor holding the object. And if those of you who know that, is the idea of applied thought and sustained thought is just totally out of the question when you get to such deep states of meditation. It does not mean that at all. It means the subverbal mind moving onto the object, which is the bliss, and holding it is the sustained vichara. And that means the first without either of those is called the first jhana. Without both is the second jhana. And the state in between is the one and a half jhanas, which is mentioned here, which is also mentioned by Sariputta. It's a stage just between the first and the second jhana, which is legitimate. What happens after that nimitta? You tend to sort of fall into it, or it sort of embraces you. Instead of the perception of the light, your perception, your object of the mind in these jhanas is the sheer bliss of it. It's the bliss which is the object. And that bliss in the first jhana, it's just the last bit of holding on to the bliss. It is an excessive effort, but only very, very tiny. Holding on to it, and because you're holding on to it, the stillness is disturbed. You move away. But the intensity of the meditation is so great, you're attracted back into that that bliss. Basically, it appears like a wobble in the meditation. The bliss, but it's not still. Almost, but not 100%. The holding on to it is the cause. That's the what they call the vitakka. The holding on to it. The moving on to it is the vitakka. After a while, you loosen your grip on that bliss, basically through trust, through faith, through more letting go. And then, because you're holding on to it, the mind doesn't move away. It's stable, but you are actually still holding on to it, which is why that state where it says there's no vitakka but still vichara, it really belongs to the second jhana, not really the first, because it's a still state. So it's first, the second jhana is basically where there is still vichara, but absolutely no vitakka. And of course, eventually, because you know you're not moving, you don't need to hold on anymore. You're still, you got to that second stage of stillness, and that is the second jhana. So this is said by the Buddha here, but it's also pointed out by Sariputta. It's the stage between the first and second jhana, but really it belongs to the second jhana. And then I develop the stillness with rapture, I develop the stillness without rapture. The stillness with the rapture, that's their piti, that's with the first and second jhanas, the one without is the third and fourth jhanas. I develop stillness accompanied by the sukha, I develop stillness without the sukha, one is the third and the other one is the fourth jhana. Different ways of just categorizing these jhanas, depending upon whether there's a movement onto the mind, whether there's a holding onto the bliss, whether there's this thing called rapture, whether there's this thing called sukha. To explain what these things actually are, I reckon is almost impossible. It's when you move from the second jhana to the third jhana, there's something which is missing. It's a different state, really perceiving that, and you know what second jhana is? This is a stage more peaceful, more still, more intensely blissful. Why? There's something missing, and that thing which is missing is called this quality called pity, Call it joy, call it rapture, I don't know what you wish to call it. None of those words really make much sense, because a lot of people don't understand what this actually thing is until it disappears. And then, of course, when the sukha disappears, you get into the fourth jhana, and then you understand what sukha is. It's from those experiences that I developed that simile, the tadpole and the frog. Tadpole can't know what water is. When it gets to be a frog, it's out of the lake, something has disappeared, that's what water is. So don't try and ask me what is pity, what is sukha. You have to really become a frog to understand what those things are. You got the microphone, Chris? So off you go.
Ajahn, when you're focusing on the bliss and you're going into the centre of the nimitta, and you're saying how you've got a sense of applying yourself to the focus, but then when you just merge into that bliss, is that accompanied by a sense of real evaporation? You know, there's just no you left at that point. And are you saying that is the second jhana, or that's the first?
Sorry, no, can you...
Are you saying that's the second jhana, that real sense in the first jhana, there's a sense of you holding it, the bliss, but in the second jhana, then your sense of yourself absolutely evaporates. It's just the bliss.
It's... not always, because many people get a first jhana experience and there's so much of what they recognize as their identity has vanished that many times even the first jhana people come out and they think that this is selfless, I've vanished, I've disappeared. When they get to be a second jhana, they realize, actually more of me has disappeared. So there's some part of me which I wasn't really all that aware of. But certainly even in the first jhana, people take that as being a selfless state. That is why in the Hindu tradition, or even in the mystic Christianity of the Middle Ages, when somebody achieved that state of first jhana, they called it union with God. They had vanished. They had, surrendered themselves to God. Now, I'm just talking from a Christian perspective. That's not accurate, but that's, you can understand where they're coming from. If you use that perception, you surrender your sense of self. All the doing, I give myself all the doing, God, you take over. That degree of letting go, if you have that degree of faith, and you guys haven't got that faith, even Christians haven't got that faith these days, that absolute faith which people had in those Middle Ages was enough to let go to such a degree. I can imagine, yes, some of those guys could, and girls got into those jhanas, the first jhana. And when they got in there, everything they could recognize from this, of their self was not there. So straight away, if I'm not here, what's left? That was God. Power, bliss, love. I'm interested as how many people perceive even the first jhana, or that state of incredible peace, as thy ultimate love. Especially those people who have glimpses of those experiences, near-death experiences, going into the light and going to a place where everything is so peaceful and just the whole world is at one and at love. That to me is like a taste of like a first jhana experience, which people have when they do these near-death experiences. And of course, you've all heard me say that that light which you see when you die or in a near-death experience is none other than these nimittas. So if you want to know how to die well, look at this... this Upakalesa Sutta. When you see the light, make sure you go through all these checklists so you don't blow it when you die. Otherwise, you have to come back again.
Ajahn, quite some years now, you've said that when you go into jhanas, that usually it's something where you're going to stay in those states for a long time. I've been listening to Kema, and I sort of get the impression that that's the case, but is it mandatory to be in a jhana for 3 and 4 and 5 hours, or can you go into a jhana for half an hour? Or is it not really a will thing, is it? There's no will implied.
Yeah, it's,
does it vary, or is it usually just a long time?
How long you go into jhanas for, it can be a will thing. You can predetermine how long you stay in there by giving the instructions at the beginning. Within the jhanas is no will, but if you're skilled meditator, you say, I'm going to enter the jhana for half an hour or an hour or 2 hours. That gives you a sense of control. But you have to do that at the beginning of the meditation, but not sort of anywhere close to achieving those jhanas. And then it works. Usually, though, if you get into one of the, even the first jhana, it's so pleasant. You know, you just can't come out. You're having a good time. Obviously, that I should have mentioned, you get what I call ping pong jhana, bouncing. And that's usually the first experience for many people of a jhana. You get the beautiful nimitta, and a lot of times, you know, you haven't got a clue what you're doing. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, you sort of allow it to happen. Because, you know, you're totally out of control simply because of stupidity. Stupidity can be a wonderful asset when you're meditating. So what happens is you go in, but wow, and you just come out again. So ping pong jhana is there, but usually if you really go in, you stay in a long time because who wants to come out?
Ajahn, the other thing is that with this Upakalesa Sutta, the Buddha is listing nine different or seven or nine different conditions of what you should and shouldn't do. You've said in the past you set these up through an aditana. But then in the past you've said when you use aditana, just one or two, but don't list a whole shopping list of requirements when you use aditanas. So where do you stand with this one, Ajahn?
Well, I stand with this one. There is usually, I say the two big ones, the fear and the excitement. It's usually not both, it's one or the other. So the fear and excitement are the big upekalesas, the one which most people experience, which stops them getting into the jhanas. The other ones, yeah, they're there as well, but, you know, they're not the big problems. The longing is number three, you know, in the list, as far as I'm concerned. I'm doing this from personal experience, but also the years as a teacher talking to other people. So that fear and excitement, it's quite cute really, because you've been there, so, oh yeah, I remember that. And, you know, it's just great, you got so far. Yeah, well done. You know, okay, you slipped up at the doorstep to something wonderful, but brilliant. You've done a really, really good job getting that far. It's okay, next time, remember, don't be afraid. Go for it. Now, don't get excited. Get excited later. Give yourself another medal after the meditation, not try and give yourself a medal in the beginning of the meditation. You deserve a medal, but, you know, just don't give yourself it at the wrong time. Yeah. Okay, I have to just, maybe, Cheng, or maybe I'll stop you because we're running out of time. And maybe afterwards, because remember last time I did restrict you to three questions and you've already overcome those. So we'll just finish off. If you want to ask a question, I'll be here so you can ask it personally afterwards. So we've got to finish off now because we've gone another half an hour over. So, paragraph 32. When Anuruddha, I had developed concentration or stillness with applied thought and sustained thought. When I had developed stillness accompanied by equanimity, all these different types of jhanas. Remember, this is only just the four jhanas, not mentioning at all about the arupas. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance is unshakable. This is my last birth. There is no renewal of being. There's no reincarnation or rebirth. I love that because there you see the causes of the enlightenment was going through these jhanas and then the deliverance happened. So there's no mention of insight there, but insight would have happened anyway. So never think that, oh, the only way you can get enlightened is insight meditation. Here is a sutta which says it's just jhana and you are enlightened. Insight will happen. When they say insight, jhana would have been there as well. Sometimes the suttas only mention the most pertinent part of the enlightenment process. The other parts are assumed to have been there. So here, because of these deep meditations, the Buddha had the insight which came as a result of those to know that he was arahat. The deliverance is unshakable, means once you are enlightened, unshakable, you're always enlightened. You can't shake it out. You can't sort of regress. The last birth, there's no more rebirth. That is what the Blessed One said. The Venerable Anuruddha was satisfied. By Venerable Anuruddha, it meant the other two monks as well. And delighted in the Blessed One's words. That is the Upakalesa Sutta. A great teaching on the higher parts of meditation. Brilliant by the Buddha. And I hope I've explained it well. There are questions from overseas, so if you can just wait for a few moments. So no more questions from the floor because these are questions from overseas. Elizabeth from Canada. Ajahn, would it be possible to explain the concept of a nimitta? Is it a meditation phase? I'm a Rinzai student, not familiar with the term. The nimitta is the word we use for that light which appears in the mind when the five senses disappear. That's the usual time the light appears. If you want more information on that, I refer you to my book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, which is published by Wisdom Publications in Boston. And there I go into the explanation of nimittas, how they arise and what to do with them in more detail. But the nimitta, when you're meditating and you get very, very still, because of stillness, things vanish. Nothing moves, so the mind does not attend to it anymore. And especially the body vanishes, the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, and obviously the physical touch vanishes, the breath vanishes, and then the mind, the sixth sense, appears. The usual way in which it appears is the beautiful light which appears in the mind, otherwise known as nimitta. Another one, Chatosh in Adelaide. Is a nimitta an achievement or a distraction for further advancement of meditation? Nimitta is a stage of letting go. Don't call it an achievement. It's what happens when you let go. And the same as the jhanas, I coined the word that these are stages of letting go to make sure that people don't misunderstand these as stages of attachment. They are stages of letting go. They're not a distraction for further advancements of meditation. They are a stage on the path of meditation, a stage you have to go through to get into the jhanas. So they're part of the path of meditation. Dear old Kanchana in Perth, Venerable Sir, I once heard you refer to both the words Vayama and Virya as courage. Is this an accurate translation? Are these two words synonyms? Metta and Anjali. Is Virya in particular comes from a Pali word, Vira, means a hero. And that is the word over here. It means like heroic effort. The word Vira as a hero was used in the military sense in India 26 centuries ago when people were fighting each other with armies. This was a soldier who would go into battle willing to give their life for the cause. That became the hero. They're heroic by the amount they're willing to abandon and let go and renounce. So seeing that connection between the Pali word Vira and Virya means that this energy, this effort, it's not any type of effort or energy. It's an effort which carries with it, you know, this heroic letting go, this effort to renounce everything, that type of heroic letting go effort. So, you know, making that connection between letting go and effort is Virya. And lastly, Elizabeth from Canada. If you would be... Oh, another one. Oh, she's done two questions. If you'll be so kind, please let Ajahn Brough know his words have literally kept this new window alive and helped bring some peace. Much love to him. Thank you. Okay, so please excuse me for going over time. It was a very important sutta, and of course this is now on the internet, so it can be a resource for anybody in the future. So may they enjoy the explanation here. I tried my very best to live up to the depth and power of this sutta so people who get into those deep meditations can know exactly what's happening and take it further, get into jhana and go all the way. Very good. Sadhu, sadhu.